Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
In a new section in Isaiah today, in chapter 13 through 23 is the discussion of the judgment of the nations surrounding Palestine, the people of God, the Holy Land. We're going to be dealing with the judgment on the nation of Babylon today, which is in chapter 13, 1 through 14, 23, and really is picked up again in chapter 21, verses 1 through 10. If you'll look at a map in the back of your Bible, you will see that the Fertile Crescent is the valley or the area that's drained by the Tigris-Euphrates River. This is known as the Fertile Crescent in the Old Testament. The earliest known civilization we know there is the one started by Nimrod in Genesis 10, known as Sumeria, or the Sumerians. There are three major world powers that affect the people of God in the Old Testament. The first one is Assyria. The second one is New Babylon. And the third is Medo-Persia. Now, we're talking about the second in this first account, which would be Babylon. Now, Babylon is known in the Bible as a very cruel and oppressive kind of governmental form or polity. And it becomes a synonym or a metaphor for cruelty. We can see this in the New Testament, where in 1 Peter 5:13, Revelation 14:8, 16:19, and 17:5, Babylon is used as a cryptic reference for Rome. So really it refers to any human governmental system apart from God. And that's the connotation here. Now, if you'll notice, it says, the oracle concerning Babylon. Now, the word oracle in Hebrew is the word burden or load. Many call this whole section the burden of Isaiah because this word oracle is mentioned so many times in connection with judgment. Some translations even call it doom oracle. It was a heavy message on the prophet, a load, a burden. Now, when it says, which Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw, many, many people are going to deny this section to Isaiah simply because the period of history here goes beyond his life. And they say that prophecy has to be really history or just on the verge of history where these men could see it. Well, I believe in a supernatural God, and I believe in supernatural prophecy, and I believe Isaiah wrote the whole book, and the Bible says right here, Isaiah saw it. So I think our critical presuppositions about the nature of prophecy is probably inappropriate here, and we have predictive prophecy, so common and so accurate for the Bible. Now, on verse 2, it mentions about raising a standard on a bare hill. What we have in verses 2, 3, and 4 is the gathering of a large, noisy, boisterous army. And we're going to learn over here from verse 17 what that army is. But we're not told till verse 17. But we're talking about the destruction of the nation of Babylon, represented in the king of Babylon, represented in the capital city called Babylon. And it's going to switch from nation to king to city. Now, look at verse 3. It says, I have commanded my consecrated ones. Now, this is going to seem very unusual, but this is a reference to Cyrus's army. In verse 17, he's called a Mede. His empire is known as the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, Cyrus was not a believer as far as a biblical person, but he is called by some very high-flying titles. Matter of fact, in Isaiah 44:28, God calls him my shepherd. In Isaiah 45:1, God calls him my anointed, which is the term for Messiah. Now, this is because he is an instrument of God's judgment. Now, Assyria in Isaiah 10:5, God calls Assyria the rod of my judgment, and then he brings Babylon on the scene to punish Assyria. Now, Babylon has been God's means of punishing his people, but now God's going to hold them responsible, and Persia is going to discipline and defeat Babylon. So the consecrated ones refers to the non-believing Medo-Persian army. I know that sounds a little funny, but that's what it is. Notice where it mentions here, my proud exalting ones to execute my anger. Friends, one thing all the prophets believed is in that God was in control of all history. All nations were under the control of God. He is the one true God. Now, there may be angels for the different nations, as we learned from the book of Daniel, but God's in control of all history. That's important for us to hear that. Now, notice in verse 6, it talks about, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. Now, here's that day of the Lord in the sense of God's judgment coming upon Babylon. Now, we must remember that the Old Testament uses contemporary historical events to foreshadow ultimate eschatological events. And so here the last day is used of the fall of Babylon, but ultimately of the fall of all human governments. Now, in verse 7 is a series of metaphors. Well, before I get to verse 7, see the word from the Almighty? This is the word El Shaddai. This is the patriarchal name for God. They did not know God as Yahweh until Exodus 3 with Moses. This is what the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, called God, El Shaddai, God Almighty. Now, in verse 7 and 8 is a series of metaphors to describe the terror and the helplessness of the Babylonian army. Their hands will fall limp. Their heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pain and anguish will take hold of them. They will read like a woman in labor. Their faces will be aflame, a blushing, either fear or shame. And all these are metaphors of the horror this enemy army will feel as it confronts the army of Medo-Persia. Now, in verse 9 again, the day of the Lord is coming. And there's that reference again to the fall of Babylon. Notice in verse 10 and in 13, a very unique literary genre of biblical literature that we usually call apocalyptic literature. And the reason we do that, it's a series that involves a lot of colors, a lot of numbers, a lot of wild animals, a lot of turmoil in nature. It's a real wild kind of literature. You see it in the book of Daniel. You see it in the book of Ezekiel. You see it in the book of Isaiah. You see it in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, the book of the Revelation. All of that is apocalyptic literature. Now, here we have the idea, the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. And look at that, verse 13. I shall make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place. Now, apocalyptic language is used to describe something that's beyond human capacity. Usually, it's God moving into his world, either for judgment, which causes great disruption, or blessing, which causes the earth to be fruitful and abundant and rejoice. Here, it's apocalyptic in the sense of judgment. By the way, the words, little phrase, the stars of heaven, is the plural form of the constellation we know as Orion. So literally, it's Orions, okay? By the way, it's a strong way for the Bible to affirm that God is control of all the heavenly bodies. They do not represent gods. They do not control men's lives. Horoscopes are a bunch of bunk, pure bunk. God's in control of men, not the spiritual deities or other gods behind planets and stars. Now, notice if you would, in verse 15, we have a series of metaphors to describe the horror of war and invasion and siege. Notice, I will thrust them through. They will fall by the sword. Their little ones I will dash to pieces before their eyes. God help us. Look at verse 18. Their houses will be plundered. Their wives will be ravished. Now, this is the horror of the invasion that's going to come upon Babylon, because Babylon did the very same thing to the people of God. Now, Medo-Persia, with God's leadership, will do it to Babylon. Now, in verses 17 and following, we have mentioned the specific country, the Medes. Now, I hope you'll look at Jeremiah 51:11, where the same country is mentioned. And here's a map of Medo-Persia, and you can see how wide this Fertile Crescent power was. Also notice it says, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. This Medo-Persian Empire was so mad at Babylon for the way they were treated during the time of Babylonian ascendancy that they were after revenge. They wouldn't take bribes. They wouldn't take any prisoners. It was pure revenge. It was a terrible kind of thing. Now, in verse 18, it mentions their bows. Now, we know from history that one of the major elements of the Medo-Persian army was their archers. This seems to be a reference to it here. In verse 18 it says, the fruit of the womb, this means unborn children, pregnant women will be killed. As Sodom and Gomorrah, we see that in verse 19. You might well see Genesis 19, 24 through 28. Notice the parallel in verse 19 between the Babylonians and the term Chaldeans. Chaldeans can be a racial term like the Babylonians, or later it came to be identified with the wise men like Daniel, often called the Magi or the Medes. So it has two purposes. Wise men are racial groups, which would be the Babylonian background. Now, notice in verse 21, I think there's a real allusion here to the supernatural powers involved. Now, let me explain what I'm doing. In the Old Testament, when two nations fought, behind those two nations stood their deities. And those deities controlled the destiny of the nations. Now, we believe from biblical history that God was behind history. But from the book of Daniel, and seems like part of a book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, there are angels behind the nations. So when these two nations fight, their leaders are representing religions, okay? Now, in verse 21 and 22, I think there are some references to the demonic. I have a graphic I want to show you because the allusion is rather veiled in English. The word owls really means howling creatures. The word shaggy goats is the word for satyrs that is used for the demons in Leviticus 17:7 and Isaiah 34:14 and 15. Now the term Raphaim used in 14:9 is of dead men, ghosts, shades we often call them. Now the word leaders of the earth is really the term for male goats, and you see the allusion there. Now in this chapter, verses 21 and 22, and in the close of chapter 14, these wild animals. These are animals that live alone out in the desolate places. This is either a metaphor for the desolation left the city of Babylon after the invasion, or it is a reference to the haunt of these supernatural demonic powers that haunt these places of desolation, and which it is, I'm not sure. Now, chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, start with a brief promise, it seems, to the people of God. Now, there have been two separate views here, and I want to show you why. The word Jacob seems to refer to the tribe of Judah. The word Israel to the northern 10 tribes. The people of God are going to be brought back together, and God's going to have compassion on them. Now, it says, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. This seems to be a reference to foreigners coming to the God of Israel. It seems to be a thing reflecting Genesis 22:18 about through Abraham's descendants, the Messiah, all the families of the earth will be blessed. But in verse 2, it talks about these foreigners will be the servants of the people of God, which seems to mean that those who once dominated them will now serve them. It's either that verses 1 and 2 refer to the same group, or verse 1 refers to blessing, and verse 2 refers to servitude. And I'm not real certain which it is. Now, in verse 3 and following, I want to say to you this has caused much discussion. Verses 3 and following is both poetry and prose. Verse 3 and 4 are a prose introduction to a long poem beginning in verses 4 through 22. Verses 23 and 24... 22 and 23 form a prose conclusion. Now this poem has caused great, great difference in interpretation because it seems to obviously refer to the king of Babylon, but through history, Christian interpreters have made verses 12 through 15 refer to Satan. I have a graphic I would like to show you that we can talk through this before I get into the detailed exegesis. This chapter obviously describes the destruction of the king of Babylon as exemplified in the city of Babylon, just as Ezekiel 28 describes the destruction of the king of Tyre. However, this king is used by God as an instrument to do his bidding, and yet his bidding was a negative bidding to punish his people. Now, pride came in and caused this king's heart to be lifted up. God's going to judge him on account of his pride. This is a story of the rise to greatness and immediate ruin. Satan is the ultimate example of this rise to God's service and fall to immediate doom. Now, also I want to realize why this passage has been so often eluded as a reference to Satan. First of all, the Latin Vulgate, done by Jerome, translates the title of verse 12 as Lucifer. Tertullian and Gregory the Great relate this text to Luke 10:18, which Jesus says, "I saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven," and on in the book of Revelation about a war that was in heaven. Both Dante's Inferno and Milton's Paradise Lost have used this as a background to their describing Satan and his antagonism to God. Verses 12 through 15 do seem to describe a pride beyond supernatural, beyond human ability, pride in a supernatural sense. Now, I really believe that what we have here is a historical description of the king of Babylon, but he is so accurately described as a pawn of supernatural powers, and his history is the history of the evil one on a spiritual ultimate level. Now, let's get in the text if we could. Notice where it says, "And you will take up this taunt." Now, the word here in Hebrew is the word mescal or mashal, which is usually translated proverb. But I think the idea here is a metaphor, the poetic meter is of a funeral dirge. Now, notice if you would, if you'll begin reading in verse 3, it's obvious that we're talking about a human king, about his pride and all that he was into. Notice it says, "The whole earth is at rest and quiet." Verse 7 and 8, "As God coming into nature causes great disruption, the sun turns to blood, the moon quits shining, God coming for blessing causes a great peace, great agricultural abundance, great fertility in humans and animals." A good example of this in the New Testament would be Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 22. So 7 and 8 are God's coming in blessings. Now, the idea about the cypress trees and the cedars of Lebanon, many believe that the invaders, these trees were so prized for their beauty and their dependability and their strength that they cut all the trees to use in building projects in their own land. So verse 8 says, "Since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes against you." This either means that Babylon exported a large number of these trees, but Babylon would fall, or it means the land will be secure and at rest. No one will be cutting the trees. Now, verse 9 through 11, I've entitled Sheol's Welcoming Committee. Now, the term Sheol is the Old Testament counterpart to the New Testament Hades, which I think is the holding place of the dead. It is mentioned several times in Scripture, especially the Old Testament. It's described as the afterlife in the early parts of the Old Testament, especially the book of Job. Men are conscious, but they are a pale shadow of what they once were. There is no joy in Sheol. There is little discussion. The presence of God is not there. It is a pale, shadowy existence where we get the terms the shades used in verse 9. You might want to see Job 3, 17 through 19, Job 21, 23 through 26 as a background to this. The New Testament seems to follow the rabbinical interpretation that Sheol and Hades were divided. There was a righteous part and a wicked part. The wicked part was called Tartarus, used in the book of 2 Peter, and the righteous part was called paradise. It is my opinion that when Jesus told the thief on the cross, "Today you will be me a paradise," he meant Hades. I hope you'll send for a tape where I've dealt with these terms, Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, and Tartarus, and that tape's available to you if you'll just write for our free catalog. Now, notice it's kind of a sarcasm. All the kings of the earth that Babylon defeated are sitting on their thrones in Hades, a pale throne, and they're saying, "You mean fancy big mouth about to come and be with us?" And they all stood up to greet the king of Babylon, who was no more a hot shot than they were in the afterlife. And that seems to be the connotation here. Now, in verse 12 through 15 is the third strophe of this poetical form. And it seems to go together. And this is where people say this is too far, goes far beyond human pride. Well, let's look at verse 12. "Oh, how have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, O son of dawn." Now, some relate this to Lucifer, which means light bearer. But I really think, and some relate it to the idea of lightning in Luke 10:18. But to tell you the truth, ladies and gentlemen, this is a reference to Venus, the morning star. It arises first, but when the sun comes up, the glory is ellipsed, and you can't see it anymore. It's still there, but you can't see it. This is the idea of the pride of the king of Babylon in comparison to the glory of God or the Messiah. And so really, it's simply an illusion. The star of the morning is the Hebrew shining one, and I think it's reference to Venus. Notice where it says in verse 13, I will rise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit in the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. Now, you ought to see Psalms 48:2 with this same allusion to a northern mountain where God dwells. Now, it can't be Sinai, for that's a southern mountain. Now, I really believe that most of ancient mythology has a core of truth. The idea of the gods of Mount Olympus coming down and marrying women, I believe, is alluded to in Genesis chapter 6, where the angels really did that. I also believe the idea of Mount Olympus, where the gods live, this is the Semitic form of that, this high, far realm in the north where God's heavenly council met. I think those pagan myths have been perverted. You see, I don't believe we're evolving to higher spiritual truth. If the Bible's true, everything since the Tower of Babel has been a fall from truth. All men originally knew God, but since Babel, there's been a corruption of those of that knowledge, and we get all these ancient mythological accounts. Now, notice where it says in verse 14, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. Now, that to me is very, very reminiscent of Genesis chapter 3, verse 5, where Satan told Eve, if you eat the fruit, you'll be like God. You see, I think that's what caused Satan to fall, wanting to be like God. I think that's what called Adam and Eve to fall, wanting to be like God. And the human race has never got over that insidious temptation to be like God. The modern heresy of Mormonism is a good ultimate example of man wanting to be God. Now, if you'll notice this, notice it says, nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol. But in fact, before I leave that ideal, I want to give you a few references elsewhere in the Bible of men who tried to be like God and pride was their downfall. You ought to see Nebuchadnezzar II in Daniel chapter 4. You ought to see the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28, 13 and following. You ought to see the Antichrist, the coming evil one incarnate, personified in Daniel 11, 36 and 2 Thessalonians 2, 4. What a temptation to be like God. And godless rulers have fallen for it throughout the history of man. Now, in verses 16 through 19c is the fourth strophe of this poetical meter. It is the astonishment. We've left heaven now, or the Mount of the Most High, and now we've come back to earth. A battle scene. Excuse me. And here, the dead body of the king of Babylon lies on the battlefield, and all the people surround him saying, is that the big shot? Is that the one who made the world tremble? Well, he's dead. Now, notice we have a play here between verse 19. You have been cast out of your tomb, and then later, who go down to the stones of the pit. It was a horrible thing for a man to be unburied. Royalty was buried in fine, fine tombs, like the pharaohs. Here, the king of Babylon will only have a heap of stones on the battlefield to mark his grave. Now, in verse 20, you will not be united with him in burial because you have ruined your country. Here in verse 20, his descendants are so mad at him because it'd be like if Hitler had children, everybody would look down on them because of their ancestor. Well, the ancestors of the king of Babylon, who I don't think is really one specific Babylonian king, but the ideal king of this godless world power, descendants are going to say, oh, they're going to be persecuted and ridiculed because of what their ancestor did. And I think that's what we have. Now, in verses 22 and 23 is a prose conclusion to this whole section. Notice in verse 23 it says, I will make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. What a strong metaphor, declares the Lord of hosts. Now, this hedgehog and swampland, if you notice anything about the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, it is a very low area. It was swampy. This seems to me to be a metaphor about the desolateness of the city of Babylon. Now, we know from Daniel chapter 5 that the Medo-Persians under Cyrus did not destroy Babylon, but captured it. Later, after revolt, part of the wall was destroyed. But through history, finally, that beautiful city, that wonder of the world, whose walls were so thick and so far around, was completely destroyed. And no one lives there today. It's almost like the curse of God came through successive power struggles, and today it's in ruins. That which seems so certain, so colossal, so big, everlasting in our day, one word from God, and it is a whisper over which even cattle don't graze, which demons and wild animals, solitary animals, live. Friends, God is in control of history. Men trusted in their power and ability and organization, and they fail. If the day comes where we ever trust in that instead of our God, we too will fall, and justly so. It is something to think about. I hope you will sever the tape on these different terms for the afterlife, Hades, Gehenna, Sheol, Tartarus. I think it'd be very helpful to you. I've really enjoyed being with you. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.